Good morning. This morning, we're going to talk about fairness in our services and our Universalist Unitarian principles regarding the inherent dignity of all. There will be a special forum in the parish hall during the second service where some folks who are working on particular issues of fairness and equality will talk about their activities. Some of you, I hope, will attend. This reading will give you a sense of how many of us look at how we need to be engaged in making sure there is fairness in how we in our society act. It takes work, constant work. The words are by Dorothy Day, who was an American journalist and social activist who advocated pacifism, direct aid to the poor and homeless, supported farm laborers, and was dedicated to building a more just and peaceful world. Commitment. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do. Inequality has reached such toxic levels that it corrupts our relationships and threatens our democracy. In an article entitled Our Home Unequally Divided, Peter Morales, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, wrote those words. He went on, "We are being poisoned. Inequality in America has reached extreme proportions." Those are strong words, and I think so important, I want to read them all to you. These are his words. The seven principles of the Unitarian Universalist Association speak of human dignity, freedom, compassion, justice, equity, democratic process, and peace. All of these cherished religious values are threatened by the stunning levels of inequality we are witnessing. Inequality is at a historic high in America, and inequality is higher here than in any other developed nation. We typically think of inequality as primarily an economic issue with political implications. This is a grave error. Voter suppression, benefits, and food assistance are not the inevitable results of natural processes. We are enduring dehumanizing inequality because we have chosen it and created it. When we prevent people from contributing their labor, when millions of people are afraid and insecure, when we deny them their full humanity, we communicate the implicit message that they do not matter. We, in effect, deny their inherent worth and dignity. Morales continues his message to us. Our economic system is a choice. Because how we structure our economic lives involves everyone, it is a moral choice. We must, as religious people, ask ourselves what moral and religious values should guide our choices. I am delighted, he goes on, that major public figures like Pope Francis and President Obama are pointing to inequality as a defining issue of our time. This focus on inequality is long overdue. What would an economy and society founded on our religious ideals look like, he asks. First, it would have far, far less inequality. Second, we would have very different measures of success. What good does it do if we have rapid economic growth, if that growth goes to a tiny portion of the population and is purchased at the expense of environmental degradation and mistreatment of workers? Why not measure progress by its benefits to ordinary people? Building on this, I believe people need to contribute in order to have dignity. I believe it is more moral to expand employment than to create growth. Following that, I would be happy to trade growth for sustainability. in the society ruled by compassion and by responsibility to the interconnected web of existence, we would never allow damage to the environment in order to produce growth. Morales concludes, "We UUs have a long tradition of taking our deepest religious values out into the arena of public witness. Recently, we have stood on the side of love for LGBT people, immigrants, and women. We stood for love and justice in the civil rights movement and in the struggle against slavery. Today, I believe our faith calls on us to bear witness to the poison effects of that inequality."
It's one of the ways that we are living out those words that Peter Morales wrote and that Pat Yasha read for us about actually honoring the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And that's how we understand it and live it today as Unitarian Universalists in the 21st century, although those words are from the 20th century. But I think it's useful for us to remember some of the length of our story as Unitarian Universalists with this idea of the inherent worth and dignity of all people and how we came to inhabit that as a religious ideal. And you know that I am fond of telling the stories that I think we live in the echoes of today. So I think in order to answer the question, how have we as a society come to accept that, well, we live in a world where some people are hungry. We live in a world where some people don't get the medical care they need. Well, some people will just be cold in the winter. And we have in some way accepted that because it's happening, and we live with it. And there are hundreds of reasons that we live in a society where we allow that society to treat our fellow humans poorly. But the one that I think is useful for us as Unitarian Universalists to understand is our relationship to our Protestant past. And you probably can remember the part that I blame on John Calvin, but there's a more complex story of that, which I tell from time to time, and I'll tell again this morning because I think it's useful to remember how we got this pattern in our culture. One of my favorite stories about how patterns get passed to us without us remembering where they come from is the story of a woman putting we'll say Easter ham into the oven, and she cuts the end off of the ham, and then she puts it in the pan, and then she puts it in the oven. I see some people nodding. And as she's cutting the end off of the ham this year, she thinks, I wonder why we cut the end off the ham. So she asks her mother, because that's who taught her to make this particular dish. And her mother says, you know, I'm not sure. We'll have to ask your grandmother, because she's the one who taught me to do this. So they go and ask the grandmother, and the grandmother says, oh, you still cut the end off. I did that because my pan was too small. And yet that way of doing things gets passed down perhaps indefinitely if no one ever asks, why are we doing it this way? So the grandmothers that we're always in conversation with, even if we don't know it, are our Puritan ancestors. So the Puritans in New England taught that piece that John Calvin taught that I'm always arguing with, that in fact the Universalists have, well, that's the whole point of Universalism, is to be in an argument with John Calvin. We're getting cheering for other characters in our history. The Puritans taught that God had chosen some people to be saved and chosen some people not to be saved, which is Calvinism, and it's pretty grim. But the Puritans added a little twist, which is that Well, John Calvin said, some people would be saved and some people wouldn't, and you'd never know. You just have to live your life not knowing what's going to happen afterwards. The Puritan said, you might get a little bit of a sign if you're chosen. Although they used the word elect, that there were some people who were elect, and they, of course, themselves were elect. And some of the signs that you would get if you were elect, if God was just giving you a little nudge to say you are in, was that you would be prosperous, that you would do well, that there would be material and worldly signs that you were among the chosen. I see you all nodding. You can see the bind this has gotten us all into. And we're still in it. We're still in that bind. And there are actually two binds here. One is the idea that some people are better than other people. Some people are more holy, closer to God, chosen. That there's some sort of inherent difference between the worth and value of people. And the other bind is that that difference in worth and value is shown materially. That how you're doing materially is a sign of your value. Well, when the Universalists started to argue with this version and then another version that came around in the Great Awakening, they said, well, this doesn't make sense to me. This is no kind of a god to worship who would make those sorts of choices about human beings. And not only did they not think that was a great god to worship, they didn't see that kind of god in the biblical text. And our ancestors were big on going back to the original text or the original situation and saying, well, what do I see here for myself? And I happen to agree with them that if you look at the biblical text, God isn't choosing. There's no better than and worse than from the perspective of God. There certainly are people who are in terrible fixes, who are desperate for help. And in the text, they often are in conversation with God. So the Universalists, our ancestors, rejected this idea that God chose among people. And they were essentially saying there aren't people who are named better than and worse than by the divine. And they also took away the idea that your material wealth was one of the signs of how you were chosen or not chosen. So they had a great intellectual argument, and they formed churches, and we had all kinds of refutations of this way of thinking. However, our unconscious emotional patterns are still shaped by those old Puritan ideas. We're still cutting the end off of, you fill in whatever you need to in that metaphor, because patterns like that are much harder to change in that unconscious part of ourselves than they are to change in our intellectual understanding of things. This old theology shows up in the phrase keeping up with the Joneses now. And you know the pressure that you feel in the world to appear successful, to appear good enough, to make sure that your children are going out into the world and being successful. I think those are all echoes of this pattern from the Puritans. We are all preoccupied with whether we're better than or worse than. And pretty often you'll notice that those are your only choices. You're either better than or you're worse than. We're not just all inherently good, worthy of value. Which, of course, we are. We just don't always feel that way about it. And so if we are always in this bind inherited from our ancestors, assessing whether we're good enough, whether we're one of the chosen, or whether we look like we're not one of the chosen, it makes it hard to make real human contact with each other. It makes relationships, friendships, societal change hard. Because we're always wondering if we look like maybe we're not chosen. And I think that is one of the most important factors in our society about why we accept inequity. Some part of our mind still thinks that it's inevitable. It's part of the structure of the world. And some part of our mind is always preoccupied about whether we're showing signs of being chosen or not. If you talk to anyone in elementary school, they're very articulate about this bind that we humans are in. The good news is that only part of our minds is caught up with and preoccupied with this. We have other parts of our minds. And that those other parts of our minds wonder, as Peter Morales does, what it would look like if we organized our world not by those old Puritan patterns, but by our current religious values. Inherent worth and dignity, a world community with peace, justice, and liberty for all. Some of those words are words that also live in the political sphere, and there is plenty of political work to be done, and some of you are doing it. But I think our work as a religious community is a little bit different. There's a different tone and a different commitment to religious work on this question of inequity. I think it's about acting out the wondrous love that we heard in song this morning. It's about learning how to act outside of that Puritan pattern that we almost all received, even if your ancestors aren't Puritans. I think it's about creating real connections and relationships across those lines that divide us, across those lines that usually indicate who is elect and who is not. So it means deciding that, in fact, it's true that no one is better than or worse than anyone else, no matter what. And it means having our religious lives be all about creating and forming relationships and connections. Our neighbors on Maple Street are living with the great difficulties of the inequity in our country today. Most people who live on Maple Street are working one or two or three part-time jobs with few benefits and struggling to make it month to month or week to week. One unexpected car problem can mean the whole structure of their life falls apart because they can't get to their job. And if they miss a day, it all unravels. Of course, on the other end of Maple Street, we have our other neighbors. Phillips Exeter Academy, one of the most prestigious private schools in the country. And our congregation sits between them. If we are going to live into this reclaiming of worth and dignity, our goal might be to form relationships with people at both ends of the street. To remember and hold on to the worth and dignity of the people in the privileged institution and the people who struggle with everything every day. How might we form relationships with people who are our neighbors and in greater need of equity? I think when we approach relationships with people who in our culture now are often treated as if they're not as worthy, how we approach that relationship is essential. Marian actually already articulated it well this morning when she thought about giving that gift from our congregation to someone who she knew needed some help, but she was aware of their pride, of their own sense of being worthy and their own dignity. So I think there is a way to enter into those relationships that has a huge effect on how they go. So I'll tell you a story about a time that I experienced this in another context. When I was in college in rural Iowa, I took part in a program called Alternative Happy Hour. On Friday afternoons, a group of us got into a big van and drove about an hour into Des Moines. We left our pretty privileged college in the middle of the cornfields and went to a struggling neighborhood in Des Moines. Some of the buildings were falling down. The empty lots were classically littered and really empty looking. And we went to a church. What do you know? And in their side yard, we played games with some of the neighborhood kids for a couple of hours before eating dinner together in the church basement. I remember that college van rolling into the parking lot with a pretty sad-looking apartment building on the corner and one of those empty lots across the street. And children standing outside the church, elbowing each other as they watched us unload. They were wary, and we were awkward. But our leader knew how to help us enter. He already had a connection with the adults who were supervising the children, so he went over and gave one of their leaders a big hug and then said, "Let's play!" And so we just started playing, which is always a good entry. And I remember the meal that we shared was very simple. It was spaghetti and tomato sauce and bread, everything served on paper plates. And it was those paper plates that, if you hold them with one hand, sort of your meal runs off the other side. And metal folding chairs, just like our metal folding chairs, that scraped the floor. And I felt funny eating the food. I had already paid to eat food somewhere else, and it seemed wrong to eat food that was being given to people who seemed to need it more than I did. But our leader had told us it was important to eat together, that sharing a meal was an important part of how we were connecting in that most profound human way. And he was also clear that we were there to play and to make relationships, and that we were not there to fix anything or to be helpful. Well, of course, we were helpful. And of course, some things did change because we went. But we went thinking of ourselves as people who were there to learn about the neighborhood, who were there to play and be present, that was our goal. And it meant that we arrived curious, ready to laugh, ready to listen. And so we heard a lot of stories of struggle, difficulty. We heard a lot of stories of love and resilience, too. And we heard about friendship. There was one little girl who picked me out of the group as her friend. She had to sit next to me at dinner when we were both there. And she figured out that I was the one that she was going to be connected to. She never told me about her home life. She never told me what was hard about her life. But she made a connection with me. And I was always awkward about it. I was never completely sure how I should respond to her. It helped that the playtime was somewhat structured, so we always knew we could play together. I didn't keep a connection with her as I went on with my life, but I'm pretty sure that that moment of connection changed both of us a little bit. And I suspect that her family was helped also. Her parents got a chance to catch their breath, or maybe they didn't have to find someone to be with her while they worked. They knew that she got a meal. But I think the most important thing that happened is that this young person knew that she was worth paying attention to. That was the quiet agenda, and I think the most powerful one. In a society with such stunning inequality as we are willing to live with these days, what our society is saying is that we are, in fact, willing to give up on some people. But as people who are living inside of the current Unitarian Universalist ideals about humanity and the world, we want to say we don't give up on anyone. That there is no one, no matter where they are on the spectrum, no matter which end of the street they live on, there is no one who should be given up on. So it's our work in the world to not only say we believe in the worth and dignity of each person, but act on that as a congregation. And you do. You organize for and volunteer at Seacoast Family Promise when the Episcopal Church hosts it. That is one of the ways that we are in relationship with people who live at one end of the street. And as individuals, I know that you are working, and I mean working in both the volunteer sense and the paid sense, at all kinds of things that address inequality and work to reclaim people's humanity. We heard a couple of those stories this morning when I asked for stories about what you did with your little gift of money from our congregation. There are people working for Granite State Priorities and people who work for Families First. And I am sure that you are doing things that I don't know about that are shifting things here in our community. So you know what it is like to live like this, to enter into conversation and relationship, to begin that shift from a place of connection. What would it be like for us as a congregation to be more intentional about our relationship with our neighbors? How might we decide that we are students, that we are here to learn and maybe to play, but at the very least, to be curious about what our society and what our economic system look like from the perspective both at that end of the street and this end of the street. If we deepened those relationships, if we collectively started to ask questions, how would that begin to shape our response to Peter Morales' question? What would an economy and society founded on our religious ideals look like? It's a daring thing to do, to begin to propose a different economy, a different society. And maybe we don't need to have an answer to the question. Maybe we need to just go out and meet the world with our question.